I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President George Bush told reporters last night to hold their questions while he spoke directly with the American people. The president then moved to sweep aside all the debate over weapons of mass destruction in the UN and the oil and intelligence and 9/11 in order to leave one clear message.
Now is the time. And Iraq is the place in which the enemies of the civilized world are testing the will of the civilized world. We must not waver.
President Bush says he fully intends to stick to a June 30th handover of sovereignty to Iraqis, though he says it's still not clear who will accept that responsibility. Bush referred several times to the turmoil of the past 2 weeks and sought to remind Americans about his long-term goals.
There's an historic opportunity here to change the world. And it's very important for the loved ones of our troops to understand that the mission is an important, vital mission for the security of America and for the ability to change the world for the better.
Did President Bush make his case to you last night? Is the president making the case that the war in Iraq remains, as he says, an important, vital mission for the security of America? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us today, two reporters who covered the press conference last night. David Jackson is with us. He is political writer for the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News and has been covering George W. Bush for a number of years, since well before he became president. David, it's good of you to come in.
Oh, thank you.
And Carl Cannon's with us as well. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. He is author of The Pursuit of Happiness in Times of War and co-author of a book about Karl Rove called Boy Genius. Carl, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, happy to do it.
You guys were both in the room last night, and I'm always interested in knowing what you see that we don't on television. Carl, what was your impression of what you watched last night?
Well, Bush seemed very confident. And, you know, the purpose of this press conference, there were a lot of purposes, but he'd been asked, there was pressure building for him to have one. And he wanted to show the American people that he's not wavering. He used that word waver in terms of the nation, but more than that, that he's not racked by self-doubt, even though he's been seeing the same disturbing headlines and film from Iraq that all Americans have. And the body language was that it was of all of one piece, that he wasn't kidding around, that he really is that confident. And I don't mean to say that he's right about this or wrong about that. That's not my place to say. But that he believes it. That was his body language. That's what you got if you were in the room.
Same thing, Dave?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yes, yeah. I would agree with that. One thing I noticed, though, his aides were sitting off to the president's right, and they had some what I would interpret as tense expressions on their faces during the press conference. One of the things that I noted was this: the enmity between President Bush and his aides and the media. There was a little spark of tension throughout the evening, but that's nothing unusual when it comes to presence in the press.
What was that in the tone of the questioning that you're talking about, David?
It's just facial expressions, the fact that some reporters would try to insist that the President Bush answer the question and his insistence on giving his answer, not theirs.
I want to, if I can, have you both help me understand the difference between Bush delivering his sort of prepared text remarks and then when he's answering questions. And I wonder if I can do that by listening to just a tiny little segment of the news conference last night. And this is when, as Carl, you were saying earlier, Bush is reflecting very directly on what the country has been watching for the last couple of weeks.
Look, nobody likes to see dead people on their television screens. I don't. It's a tough time for the American people to see that. It's gut-wrenching. One of my hardest parts of my job is to console the family members who've lost their lives. It's a chance to hug and weep and to console and to remind the loved ones that the sacrifice of their loved one was done in the name of security for America and freedom for the world.
And, Carl, that's what you're talking about when you say basically he looks through the camera and talks directly to people?
Well, that's his message, and yeah. He believes it clearly. And he's when he sounds like that, his voice goes up just an octave, and he's sort of beseeching you to believe it, to believe him. And, everything he said yesterday, for those of us who cover the White House, everything in the prepared the remarks before the press conference and then all the answers, he said all that before, but he hasn't said it in quite this context with this 9/11 commission pointing out that, in fact, there were signs or information out there that the Iraq thing, now we're a year into it, and we've had more soldiers killed in this month than any month since the original invasion. So in this context, Bush is pulling together all of his rationale for this Bush doctrine, for this idea that to invade Iraq was part of the response to 9/11. And he says these things over and over again. If you heard in the press conference, it's very repetitious, mm-hmm. really.
Right, yes, it's kind of, the president sees himself as a straightforward, plain-speaking man. I guess he and his advisor would say they want to keep it simple for the American people, and his critics would say it's too simplistic.
And did either of you have a chance to talk as well with other people who watched this on television, just to contrast what you saw with the reaction that you're getting from people who you've spoken to?
Well, I did, and there was something interesting about that. In the room, as I said earlier, Bush appeared confident. Some of the people watched on television, and when I was a daily newspaper man like right. David is now, I used to have to watch these things off the TV and write them, you know, yeah. as they were happening in real time. And so you don't have time to think about that. But, for instance, at that question near the end where he's asked if has he made any mistakes since 9/11, you know, this was about the third or fourth attempt by the press to get Bush to admit fault or mistake. And one of the correspondents, I believe it was David Greger of NBC, even prefaced this question by saying, you never admit mistake. And in the room, Bush looked like he was caught by surprise by the wording of the question and was actually thinking and trying to come up with one. But on television, I'm told that he looked like he flubbed a question he should have been able to answer easily. So that's part of the difference of right. watching on TV. And believe me, he's not speaking to the people in the room. He's speaking to the people who watched on television.
Exactly. It's interesting. I had a very similar reaction. Looking at it myself, I thought it was one of the most effective performances I've seen him give. He gave his position. He stuck with it. I thought he was fine in person. But I talked to people who saw it on television. They found him halting. They found him evasive. But also, and I guess I have to add as well, people who saw it on television were asking me, why were reporters begging him to admit making a mistake? Several people I talked to who saw it thought the press was agitating too much for him to confess, basically.
It was interesting, that, and I'm glad you brought that to the table, because it happened, as you say, not two, three, but four times when people gave him the opportunity to say, you know, do you want to apologize? Should you apologize? And at one point, someone asked him, well, all right, if you're not going to apologize, what would you say your biggest mistake has been? And it provided one of those sort of candid, reflective moments that you've talked about.
I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, he could have done it better this way or that way. I'm sure something will pop into my head here in the midst of this press conference, all the pressure of trying to come up with an answer, but it hadn't yet.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, we're taking a listen back and a look ahead at President Bush's third primetime news conference of his presidency. Carl Cannon and David Jackson are with me from Washington. We're joined now on the line by Mahmoud Osman, who's a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, and he's joining us on the line from Baghdad. Mr. Osman, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Did you have a chance to listen to what the president said? I guess it was very early in the morning for you.
It was very early. Then I heard what he has said, not directly, really, because it was very early in the morning. And now also the phone keeps cutting, so I heard some of what you said anyway.
I want to play one piece of tape from the news conference last night, Mr. Osman. Then I'll come back and ask you about it. It was President Bush speaking about that June 30th handover and whether or not he was willing to consider perhaps moving that date. Here's what the president said last night.
We're not an imperial power, as nations such as Japan and Germany can attest. We're a liberating power, as nations in Europe and Asia can attest as well. America's objective in Iraq is limited. And it is firm. We seek an independent, free, and secure Iraq. Were the coalition to step back from the June 30th pledge, many Iraqis would question our intentions and feel their hopes betrayed. And those in Iraq who trade in hatred and conspiracy theories would find a larger audience and gain a stronger hand. We will not step back from our pledge. On June 30th, Iraqi sovereignty will be placed in Iraqi hands.
And Mr. Osman, when he was asked later which Iraqi hands the sovereignty would be placed into, he said that will come later. He wasn't very specific about that. But when he gives such a determined, when he sticks so determinedly to that deadline, how is that going to be heard in Baghdad, in Iraq?
Well, actually, in Iraq, we are thankful to President Bush because of he removed Saddam Hussein from power, which was a very, very bad government, of course. Secondly, everybody wants sovereignty to be as quickly back as possible, even though if we have had sovereignty last year when Saddam Hussein was toppled, it would have been better anyway. But, of course, the important thing is that whether we could, on the 30th of June, have a capable government that would be supported by Iraqi people, that could keep the sovereignty, rule the country, implement law, and go to our general election. That is very important. If we could have such a government even before 30th of June, that's fine. But if you cannot have it by 30th of June and things would not be under control, then I don't know how sovereignty will be there exactly. So it depends on really what things will go on then. How will the situation develop from now till 30th of June, from security point of view, from other point of view. So that is the important thing which Iraqis are thinking about.
So your advice to the president is don't worry too much about June 30th. Hand over sovereignty when Iraq is ready for that.
I think that's very important, really. I mean, they should help them and United Nations and we, all of us together, try to work out a formula that will make a government that will be really capable. That means Iraqi will be ready for that sovereignty. And whatever date that could be finished, then there will be sovereignty. Even if it's before 30th of June, that's better. So.
Quick last question, Mr. Osman. Mr. Bush also said last night that he'd be willing to send as many troops as the American generals say they need. How will that be heard in Iraq?
Well, actually, in some aspect, more troops, maybe they need it for some battles and so on, but we need more political solution. I think the question is political more than being the issue of troops, and if we could solve the things politically and you have a good government chosen, that would be very fine. At the same time, I think fighting against terrorism and ending Saddamists and people pro-Saddam, terrorists, pro-Qaeda, or these people, I think who are working in Iraq now, it's quite a good thing also for the Iraqis. So we need actually action on both fronts.
Mr. Osman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Mahmoud Osman is a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, joining us there on the line from Baghdad. One of the things, whenever the president holds a primetime news conference like this, he has so many different audiences. That in Iraq that Mr. Osman is talking about, certainly the audience here in America, Carl Cannon and David Jackson, with us in Washington to talk about the reaction and the message from the White House. We'd also like to hear from you, how you received what you heard from the president last night. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And we are talking this morning about the president's primetime news conference last night, what his message was. We heard there just at the tail end of the last segment, Mahmoud Osman talking about how it was received by his ears, and he's only one member of the Iraqi Governing Council. Lots of different opinions in that country. Carl Cannon is with us. He is White House correspondent for the National Journal. David Jackson, political writer with the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News. And David, why don't you just give us your thoughts on what you were hearing from Mahmoud Osman there, saying, you know, really, we're not that keen on a June 30th deadline if we're not ready for power.
Oh, my thoughts were that June 30th is going to be a very interesting date in American political life. I don't think anybody really knows what to expect when the end of June rolls around because on the surface of it, it looks very difficult to hand over sovereignty. But on the other hand, people will tell you that handing over sovereignty really isn't that big a deal. It's basically signing some papers and putting up different names on different offices, but the American military will still be there, and it'll still be a heavy U.S. presence and U.S. influence on whatever happens there. I'm sure there are a lot of different opinions in Iraq as to what to do. And one other thing that's mentioned, that President Bush mentioned, is there's this U.N. envoy trying to negotiate some kind of deal regarding June the 30th, and that's something to keep an eye on because that could help the situation, and it could also enable President Bush to claim international cooperation in Iraq, which is something John Kerry's been bashing him about the last couple of months.
Well, Dick, may I
yeah,
add something
ahead,
here? Last night, the president outlined a whole timetable, you know, and he went through June 30th and then to just October and other
December
signings,
05.
December, right up to 05, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, in fact, even beyond. Well,
uh-huh.
Well, he's not even sure he'll be president still. But it was an interesting thing. He's often, you know, some of his critics have said he lacks a vision. He has to explain what he's doing. But in that exchange, he was outlining what he sees as Iraq's future, and even told one of the few vignettes where he veered from his script about sitting down with the Japanese prime minister recently, having dinner with him and talking about what they should do about North Korea. And then said, you know, someday a future president will sit down with the president of Iraq. And he was going back to the World War II analogy, a former enemy in a country we invaded. I mean, they invaded us first, but a country mm-hmm. we dropped the atomic bombs on mm-hmm. and then helped rebuild. And Bush really was giving a vision. And the question now is not whether he has a vision. He clearly does. It's whether it's a realistic vision. Mm-hmm. The reporters, conversely, were sort of dwelling on the past, and Bush was dwelling on the future. And that's kind of where presidents want to be. I mean, in that respect, Bush was doing what he needed to do.
Did he?
Right, yeah, before the news conference, Eames has won the way forward. He wants to talk about the way to move forward. That was their mantra in the White House, and obviously it's probably a good thing for a politician in Bush's position to do.
But from either one of you, what kind of political problem has he created for himself by putting that big black X through June 30th? I mean, he talks about, you know, raising the flag of a free Iraq, assuming full responsibility for the ministries of government and you know, the transitional administrative law and so on and so forth. But, I mean, David, as you point out, it's anybody's judgment as to what that handover of sovereignty will be. But he's not really in a position to change that date now, is he?
No, not at all. I suspect something will happen on June the 30th, and then the debate will be whether it's meaningful or not, whether Iraqis truly have sovereignty or just have it only on paper.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Georgetown, Indiana, and Gary's joining us. Hi, Gary.
Hi, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, nice to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Well, what I'd like to say first, and I'm really puzzled, and you seem like very intelligent people. I spent two tours in Vietnam, and I was in charge of men, and you make mistakes. And that's life, but you had to be responsible for it, regardless whether you created the situation or not. It's like, you know, you're in charge. The guy's in charge. He's got to be held accountable. And why can't any of those guys, especially the president, he's my commander-in-chief, say, yeah, we made a couple mistakes here. We're going to fix it. Why dodge that question? It just puzzles me. I've got an 18-year-old boy sitting there. He goes, Dad, what do you think? And I said, I would not go into battle with a commander-in-chief that won't admit a mistake. Why is that? I'm just really puzzled by it.
Yeah, as was I at one point in the news conference last night. Carl and David, why does the president, what's the reasoning behind this? Because it was clearly marching orders going into the news conference.
He wasn't asked a question. Look, this is my guess to the caller, because I think this is an important point he's raised, but he wasn't asked a question he could really answer in that way. This was not a legitimate, you know, these were gotcha questions. The closest was Elizabeth Buehmiller's question. Do you feel a sense of personal responsibility for September 11th? Well, maybe he should have just said yes, any president would, but my job is to look forward and try and prevent another one. But these questions are in a context of a campaign in which the Democrats are trying to blame Bush and the Republicans are trying to blame Clinton. And I don't think he was asked a question that he could really admit. I don't think he was asked a question in a form that he could even admit a mistake, because I don't think he thinks he made the kind of mistakes they're talking about. I would have liked to have seen a question about the battle plan, because, you know, we asked him, you know, these questions were so repetitive. Part of the reason, as I said, Bush was repetitive was because the questions were repetitive, and there was all this redundancy. Bush thinks he did the right thing in Iraq, whether or not there are weapons of mass destruction. Well, we know that. He said that 50 times. Mm-hmm. How about this question, though? You know, is the battle plan flawed, sir? Did we have enough troops? Were we right to disband the Iraqi army? Were we right to go in without Turkey so we couldn't go from the north? Why didn't we have an electricity grid so that the summer after, you know, the summer in Baghdad was 120 degrees, people didn't have electricity? Why weren't there generators brought in? Why weren't the borders sealed? I think these are the kinds of questions that should have been asked, and I don't know what Bush would say to them. None of these politicians I cover are very good at admitting fault.
David,
but you could ask him questions that could really elicit a response like that, but I'm not sure he was asked a question like that.
Well, I know also in terms of, and this is sheer politics, like it or not, most people don't, but I think most political analysts, Hillary candidates, don't ever admit a mistake because we're in such a polarized environment, you'll be jumped on and tarred and feathered for any mistake you might admit. And I deeply suspect President Bush has been advised that, and I think John Kerry's been advised that, too. Or conversely, if you do admit a mistake, admit it about something that's really not that big a deal in the first place.
Let's go back to Gary's earlier question, though, if we can, David, and just listen to what it was that the president said when he was asked about the 9/11 attacks and whether or not he felt that he had anything to apologize for in the run-up to that event.
I've asked myself a lot, is there anything we could have done to stop the attacks? Of course I've asked that question, as have many people of my government. Nobody wants this to happen to America. And the answer is that had I had any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes into buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country.
And I suspect, David, that one of the reasons why Gary's puzzling over the president's reluctance to say, you know, I am the boss and maybe we did mess up, we'll know more when the 9/11 Commission reports, is the sort of dramatic statement that Richard Clark made at the 9/11 Commission when he did sort of turn around and apologize specifically. Maybe that kind of raised an expectation.
Well, that's what inspired all these calls for. But Richard Clark isn't running for office, and President Bush is, and I can tell you, right after I got back from September, I was in New York to cover September 11th for about a week. When I got back, there were these suggestions by Republicans that Clinton left us vulnerable all 8 years, and I know the officials in the Clinton administration were outraged at the suggestion they were somehow responsible for this. Well, now it's turned around a bit, and people in the Bush administration are outraged at the suggestion they're somehow responsible for this. They say it's Osama bin Laden's fault. And in terms of 9/11 as to why the president won't apologize, I think that has an awful lot to do with it because he feels like Osama bin Laden is responsible. In general, politicians don't apologize because in this current rabid political environment, it would cause more problems than it would solve, in their view.
Someone's going to pick that up and whack you with it. That's
exactly.
The problem.
Rest assured, that will definitely happen.
Well, Dick, you know, though, in that answer that you were talking about, he also said, there are some things I wish we had done when I look back. I mean, hindsight is easy. So you know, maybe that's not good enough, but but I think in the Bush White House, they think that Clark was grandstanding, and this is an apology with no real power behind it. I mean, he's doing it to hawk a book. He didn't do it before. He didn't resign. He didn't do anything.
Right.
You know. We don't have that kind of accountability anymore, and maybe it's too bad. I remember when Waco happened and those kids were all incinerated, and Janet Reno said, I take the blame, the responsibility, but she didn't. No one lost their job, and not one person in government. And it turned out that she had checked with Clinton before she sent those tanks in there, and Clinton, you know, he never stepped forward. And what this caller did and what you're talking about, which is restoring some measure of accountability to American politics, is, in my view, long overdue. I'm just not sure you're going to get a president to do it in the middle of a war and in the middle of a campaign.
Exactly. Yeah, Dick, I think the caller's right. I think if politicians did confess error more, I think real people out in the real world would understand that and let them slide. But people get sucked into this so-called Beltway environment. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's absolutely true. And right now they're following the Henry Ford dictum, never complain, never explain.
I'm going back to our callers here. Our number, by the way, is 1-800-423-8255. And Providence, Rhode Island, Anthony's waiting there on the line. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
As I said to your screen, I want to just preface this by saying that I'm not being a partisan here. I haven't voted in years. But in watching this press conference last night, it's not so much the press conference. It's the way that you watch on TV, and even with the show, as Gary said, you are a group of intelligent people. But we insist on on taking what the president said at face value, that, you know, we have to analyze what he said. But to me, when asked these questions, and as one of your guests pointed out just a couple of minutes ago, that that some of the questions were repetitive, and they were, and that somehow leads to the president being repetitive, I don't think that it really mattered what questions he was asked. He was going to say the same thing over and over and over again, because to me, I mean, what that indicates to me is that he doesn't have any answers. He doesn't really want to be in this forum. He doesn't like doing these things. And the truth of the matter is that he's way out of his depth. If you can't answer, you know, why you have to go behind closed doors to talk to the 9/11 committee, commission, with what comes onto us, a chaperone with Dick Cheney, if you can't say why that's necessary, then to me that means you should drop out of the race right now, because you're not qualified for this job if you need a chaperone to go talk behind closed doors with people who aren't going to tell anyone what you said to them.
Anthony, let's hear from our guests in Washington.
Well, Dave, you want me to take?
Go ahead, Carl.
Well, when the president is speaking about why he's doing this in Iraq, I think the caller's just wrong. I think he's articulate to the point of being eloquent. He almost sounds Lincoln-esque. This thing in Iraq is a big idea. Now, it may be a big bad idea, but it may be a big good idea, and we don't know yet. What Bush is really saying is that he's willing to take responsibility before the electorate for the wisdom of this decision in Iraq. And to me, that's bigger than some of these gotcha questions. And if Bush flubs them, he flubs them. But when he says this freedom, when he says, you know, I also have this belief, strong belief, that freedom is not this country's gift to the world. Freedom is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman in this world. And as the greatest power on the face of the earth, we have an obligation to help the spread of freedom. And then he goes on to say we have an obligation to help the hungry and to solve AIDS. These are sentiments to me. I mean, he's got one foot in the preamble of the Declaration. I mean, if these rights that Jefferson wrote about are self-evident or unalienable, Bush is saying that the corollary in philosophy is that the yearning for them is universal. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, yes, but who can give them to him? And I think it's very tough for these presidents to sit and see suffering in the world and not do something about it. Bill Clinton decided to get involved in Bosnia when he watched people being killed on CNN in the so-called safe havens of the UN. Well, they weren't safe havens. They were killing fields. And Clinton, who had run against action in Yugoslavia when he was a candidate, as president, realized he was the only person in the face in the world who could stop it. And so I think we ought to look past some of these. I mean, Bush is not a gifted. He isn't speaking complete paragraphs, unscripted, but he's got a big idea here, and it's worth taking seriously.
I agree. Bush is committed in Iraq. He has no choice but to push forward, and he's going to repeat. First of all, it's always been his pattern throughout his career to give his view of things, not so much specifically, not give the reporter's version of events, but his version of events. So he's going to repeat his message over and over again ad nauseum. That's been his style since he entered politics. But at this point, he's committed in Iraq, and it's beyond both Bush and Kerry. It's events on the ground that are going to determine how this thing plays out politically, and it's both out of both of them's hands. In terms of why President Bush isn't testifying in public for the commission, I think it's important to note that if no president, I don't think, would willingly testify in public for any commission created by Congress or by anybody else, it's a separation of powers issue, and that's the reason for that. Now, as to why he's testifying side by side with Dick Cheney, I really can't explain that, and obviously the president wasn't in any mood to explain it last night either.
Okay, we need to move along. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Next call from Saugus, Massachusetts. Peter's with us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. The two things that struck me about the press conference last night, first was Bush's ability to convey his convictions, his simplistic convictions, in my view, despite his inability to be articulate. He kept talking about consoling family members who have died, and he talked about being under the spot. I mean, he's not quick on his feet, and he's not an articulate man, but he is able to convey, again, his convictions about what he's doing, even whether you disagree or not. But what else struck me was I was disappointed in the questions. You've already mentioned that they were repetitive. The press must have known that there was no way that he was going to apologize. Tactically, it's suicide for a politician to do that. He was not going to admit a mistake. It struck me that a great question would have been, when he admitted that Osama bin Laden, instead of an apology, he said Osama bin Laden was responsible for this, then why didn't somebody ask, why don't we put a lot more resources into Afghanistan for actually capturing Osama bin Laden? Why didn't we focus the entire effort on that rather than going to Iraq, where there's never been a connection between 9-1-1 and Iraq? That was my greatest disappointment. The entire basis of the war was weapons of mass destruction and Iraq being a threat. There's never any indication that I've seen anyway that it actually has been a threat to the United States. And I thought that was sort of left unasked by the reporters because they kept going after the apology and the mistake.
All right, Carl Cannon, you are currently president of the White House Correspondents Association. Can you, in that capacity, be critical of your colleagues? There did seem to be a kind of set piece to it. You know, this is my question. I'm going to ask it no matter what's come ahead.
Absolutely. I look, I'm the president of the Correspondents Association, but Bush didn't call on me last night, maybe because he knew I'd ask a question that was a little different from these. But I thought it was, disgraceful, too strong a word, but almost amateurish. You know, Bush has this list of people he's going to call on. In fact, in his previous East Room press conference, he uses the word scripted. He used it, which caused us unimaginable grief. People wrote in and called in, and the internet filled up with conspiracy theories. Oh, they're scripted. You know, they're stooges.
I remember that.
But what he meant was he's got a list of people he and his press secretary have agreed on who they're going to call on. But the questions aren't scripted. But in fact, they are by the reporters themselves, of course. But if you go in there and you look at these reporters looking down at their piece of paper, they're going to ask a question. Well, never mind, it's been asked 5 minutes before. And in fact, Bush even addressed it before you even asked the first question. How about maybe you ought to have two or three questions, or maybe we ought to do something that, you know, goes back to the days of spats and high button shoes, which is ask a follow-up question. So I agree with this, the gentleman who called in, although I want to correct something he said, because it's factually wrong.
Be quick,
he
Carl.
The entire rationale of the war was weapons of mass destruction. Well, that's wrong. Bush always cited, and I've read every speech he gave from the 2002 State of the Union address to the invasion of Iraq, and he always cited multiple reasons.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, reflecting on the president's words from last night. What questions would you have asked if you'd had your opportunity? What do you think is being said? What do you think is left unsaid? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join us this hour is 1-800-423-8255. We are talking about the primetime news conference held by the president last night, but it's also worth noting that as the White House correspondents were settling themselves into the East Room to hear what it was the president had to say, John Kerry had gathered a large group of fundraising, was at a large fundraiser in Boston last night. And we'll listen to just a snippet of what Mr. Kerry had to say on the same topic that the president was discussing last night.
And I hope he will explain to the American people how we will reach out to the international community and end what is essentially an American occupation of a Middle Eastern country and bring the international community to the table to share the burdens and the risks of this great enterprise.
Now, Carl Cannon is with us. He's White House correspondent for National Journal. And David Jackson, political writer with the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, if I'm not mistaken. You've actually been covering Kerry lately. How is he setting himself apart from the president as this story moves forward? Is that a Kerry line that you'd heard before?
Absolutely. You just heard it right there. He's basically saying that he's trying to walk a fine line, of course, but he's basically saying that he supported the removal of Saddam Hussein, but the president went about it the wrong way, particularly by alienating our international allies. And he's making a big issue out of the disagreements, if you will, between the Bush administration and particularly Europe, particularly France, and the United Nations, and basically saying, I can do a better job of not only getting help in Iraq, but reestablishing global alliances to deal with other international problems as well.
Now,
I think one of the things, as the campaign progresses, I think one of the things to look for is Kerry saying, hey, if Iraq continues to go bad, I think you'll hear Kerry say, hey, I can bring the UN in, I can bring us help if you elect me.
But Bush was saying last night, and I was surprised to hear him being quite so candid about this, that when it comes to the June 30th deadline, for example, he'll be looking for the advice, the input of Lakhdar Brahimi of the United Nations.
Right.
I mean, he's clearly not keeping Kofi Annan at arm's length at this point. He's looking for help, isn't he?
Exactly. And they've been relatively quiet about that. But, yes, the UN, not only that, but there are discussions with NATO to help augment our military forces in Iraq, too. So slowly but surely, I think you'll see Bush trying to internationalize the conflict. And you can expect Kerry to say, hey, he's stealing my idea.
Let's go back to our phone lines to Bridgewater, Massachusetts. John's with us now. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just have a quick question. Why didn't anyone ask the president about other issues of trust, such as the Medicare bill, what he's done to the No Child Left Behind, or his terrible record on the environment? Because when you add all of them up, there's a pattern here, for me anyway, of trust. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, John, thanks for your question.
Well, that's a good place. As following up on what Carl said a little while ago, these press conferences, they tend to dwell on the news of the day. And if you notice, he calls on a lot of all the TV correspondents and also the wire services. And as Carl just pointed out to me during the break, they have deadlines literally by the hour. So they're interested in what's going on right now. What's the news of the day? So you don't get a lot of thoughtful questions about overall general issues. And there wasn't a single question about the economy or any other domestic issue last night. It was all Iraq and 9/11. It was unfortunate.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure we ought to stand up and say, gee, Mr. Mel, President, what about your terrible record on the environment? We'd hear... We get mail on that.
But it is somewhat striking if there are going to be so few such news conferences that the reporters don't at least say, well, okay, look, if the three of you are going to talk about Iraq, what else is important? I guess there isn't that kind of conversation that happens before one of these things?
Well, you know, Dick, it's funny that we're all competitors in there. And we did that, we'd be accused of collusion. But You keep bringing this back up, and I'm glad you do, because it's been bugging me all morning. It bugged me last night, which is why these reporters can't, you know, okay, that question's been asked and answered. I've got another one. And
to me,
I was making fun. You can't ask about your, quote, terrible record on the environment, but you could say, Mr. President, you've addressed this many times. You know, there was a recession, there was this war, but should the American, you know, if the American people think that John Kerry will be as good as you on terrorism, shouldn't they vote for him if they hold you responsible for the loss of 20 million jobs? I mean, you can ask a question like that, and Bush is prepared to answer them, and I wish we'd have done more of that. I really do.
By the way, in terms of the lack of news conferences, I think I have to point out that Bush prefers to answer questions during what they call pool sprays. He'll be meeting with someone, and there'll be a press pool come in, and Bush will take two or three questions. So he has taken a lot of questions. He just does it in a different format. Now, here again, the problem with the pool approach is that here again, almost all the questions are on the news of the day.
Or the news of the hour. Dick, do your listeners know what the White House pool is? Should we explain that a little?
I think it's somewhat clear. This is a chosen group of generally wire service or newspaper or television reporters.
There's one newspaper, the wires, one network. But it's always these questions. You get these shouted questions at photo ops and Reagan, you know, walking the helicopter. It's an old foreign presidents.
You're not all there is the point that you're making.
And also, these wire people and these network people are under pressure from their producers. I mean, literally in their, you know, what about this happened 5 minutes ago? Get a reaction from the president. Well, that's not very enlightening. That doesn't do what a formal press conference would do. And this press conference last night, I mean, in fairness to these reporters that we've been picking on, they wanted their questions about Iraq answered because it's the most important issue. But if Bush did this every 2 weeks, which I think he should do, you would, in time, you'd get a better rhythm to it.
Right. Okay. 1-800-423-8255 to Pensacola, Florida now. And Sydney's joining us. Sydney, thanks for calling.
How you doing this morning?
Fine, thanks.
My question, well, it's actually a statement. Basically, all I'm trying to find out is why is everybody picking at this gentleman? I mean, he's doing a job. He has to go by information. He's the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief. If half the people really understood that this man basically goes on information, they're trying to find out, well, why did you act here? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? How did you let these people slip up? He only acted on the information that he had. I mean, our CIA, our FBI, those people, for a long time, they have this legal thing where they can't even share information. If these people are not interacting together, our president is not really informed the way he should be. I served under this man's father, Mr. Reagan, and Mr. Clinton. And
Hey, Sydney, can I ask you a question? I'm curious, if you were at a news conference like that last night, would you have a question for the president? Or do you think that these exercises of standing him up on television and asking him hard questions are out of line?
The questions, they were good questions. Some of them were kind of sideways, but the thing about it is this, though. They kept asking the same questions, but they were reworded. I mean, the man answered the question as best as he could. know, let's get to something else. Let's get to something else.
And what would you have liked to that something else to be?
I would like for them to ask him, what is he going to do next? Osama bin Laden is part of al-Qaeda. Let's go after the whole al-Qaeda, organization, not just him. Ask him questions like that right there. Why are we focused on one person that's part of a situation instead of going after the whole thing? You get Osama bin Laden, you still have al-Qaeda.
David, this is...
Had he answered that question right there, I'd have been done with it, you know?
Right. Sidney, thanks for your call. David, it's what Carl was talking about earlier, that there were a lot of places to go and issues that could have been raised, no?
Absolutely, and...
You guys got a fire alarm going on in the background there?
I don't know what's going on here. I hope we're okay.
It can't be a fire. We're in the Christian Science Monitor.
Well, then somebody will put it out, won't they?
Yeah, I suspect there are millions and millions of people who agree with the caller. In fact, I'm sitting here with my...
We may actually be having a fire.
Oh, okay. So I guess we better go.
Dave, you go check it out. I'll stay with Dave.
All right. We're going to stay with you guys for about 30 seconds, but if the line... Oh, there the jingling is done to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and John is with us. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. It seemed to me that there was another audience in mind with the president rather than the domestic one, and that would be Osama bin Laden and the opponents of the coalition in Iraq, who have been operating for a long time on the notion that if we run into resistance, we take some casualties, that we'll fold our tents and leave. And they're working on the Vietnam model on that, and that I think part of the president's intent was to support, especially in the context of the standoff in Najaf, that that isn't the case. He is unwavering, as he said repeatedly, and that he was trying to send a clear message in support of the troops, that the resistance in Iraq and elsewhere will not be satisfied by a retreat by the U.S.
So, John, how does the president keep all those balls in the air at the same time? If he is aware that his remarks, are going to be watched via Al Jazeera and the Muqtada al-Sadr's people in Najaf, and that there will be, bits of transcripts handed around the hillsides of Waziristan, and he's also talking to, Louisville. I mean, it gets a little bit...
Well, I think...
Go ahead.
Well, I think by probably keeping as few balls in the air as possible. I mean, the themes of the speech and his answers and interpretations of questions were pretty consistent. It was pretty simple in a way. He wants his basic message to get across, and I think he probably did a very good job of that. As to how you keep the balls in the air, well, as with most people, I think some will probably fall. But his intention was to try to get across to them that he is not backing off. And I think he feels it's important to make that point to the people in Najaf, to Osama bin Laden, and so on.
And did that work for, as far as you're concerned, John? When you watched the president last night, was he delivering that message with conviction?
I thought so.
Yeah.
I thought so. I thought he did very well on that.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The reason we're not going back to the boys at the Christian Science Monitor studios is that, in fact, they are in the middle of a fire alarm and they are on their way out of the studio. We hope to reconnect with David Jackson and Carl Cannon via cell phone in the latter moments of the program. But callers, stay with me. I'm going to Quincy, Massachusetts, and Harold's on the line. Harold, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, how are you today, Dick?
I'm fine, and you?
Good program. I didn't expect the television show last night to be much different than it was. I believe that the president has his resolve, and it's not going to be changed. It's unwaverable. My question, is this man on a messianic journey?
There was a line. Harold, let me just hang on half a second, because I want, for those people who didn't want watch the news conference last night, in the last couple of minutes, President Bush said to the people there, so long as I'm president, I will press for freedom. I believe so strongly in the power of freedom. And do you know why I do? The president asked. Because I've seen freedom work right here in our country. I also have this belief, strong belief, that freedom is not this country's gift to the world. Freedom is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman in this world. And as the greatest power on the face of this earth, we have an obligation to help the spread of freedom. Is that what you're referring to, Harold?
Well, whose God is he referring to? His? What about the Iraqis? I believe that what your speaker that was on the air from Iraq made sense. after the 30th, you're going to see this coalition fall apart, because already the security people that have been trained by us ran when this uprising came by Sadr and the Shiites and the Sunnis. They're not going to be able to hold it together, and we're going to have to control the whole country militarily, as we have been doing anyway. We have occupied Iraq, and they're not going to be able to handle it by June 30th.
But I don't think that it's the president's, Harold, I don't think it's the president's intention to change anything in the way of who holds the guns in that country on June 30th. They're just talking about a transfer of sovereignty, that the U.S. military will remain in control of security isn't something that he's wavered on.
So then the fact of the matter is we have occupied the country. It's going to be probably like after World War II.
How long do you think it's going to go on?
Decade? More? Depends who the next president is, really. Thank you for having me on the station. I appreciate it.
It's nice to have you with us, Harold, and we will talk more, no doubt, about what the president had to say at his news conference last night, particularly because he set down those markers, which will be sort of the journalistic issues to keep track of. June 30th, the deadline that Carl Cannon and David Jackson say has now become a very important political date, not just on the American calendar, but in Iraq, for the transfer of sovereignty. And this is my chance to thank both Carl Cannon, White House correspondent for National Journal. He's author of a book called The Pursuit of Happiness in Times of War, and co-author of a book called Boy Genius. Karl Rove, the brains behind the remarkable political triumph of George W. Bush. David Jackson was also with us. He's political writer with the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News and has been reporting on George Bush since his days as a businessman and governor of Texas. Mahmoud Osman was with us. He's a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. He was joining us from Baghdad. Thanks also to Fred Tice, reporter here at WBUR, for his assistance with today's program. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.